Here we go. Still sick. Wassail, wassail, wassail. And you say,
Hang on. Drink hail.
Here we go. Just a couple of days till Christmas. Mark is broadcasting from, it looks like Santa's grotto. It looks so festive. It's got tinsel. It's got pictures of Santa. It's got a Christmas tree. The lights are flashing. It looks absolutely
You do know,
incredible.
Don't you, that Patreon subscribers can actually see this. And
yes,
they can see that none of the things that you've just said are true.
That's
I'm
true.
Broadcasting from Ali's attic because he's got faster internet.
But what's wrong with your old place?
No, so because I had to be in London yesterday and I couldn't get down to Mousel in time to do this because it was a late finish. So I come to Ali's, which is like some of the way down.
Right.
I'm in his attic and then I'm going on down from there.
Right. Okay.
And I thought, you know, and I needed to be somewhere where the internet was fast because this is the last show that we're recording before Christmas. Therefore, there's a bunch of stuff that we had to get done. And I thought that that's not going to happen if as has happened in the past when I've been in Hampshire and I've been tethering the computer to my mobile.
Yes, which is not good.
Not ideal.
Don't forget, though, Saturday is the Kate Winslet special entitled Good Kate Winslet Lass Looks Back on Her Feats of Acting.
Good Kate Winslet Lass Looks Back on Her Feats of Acting.
Acting and directing occasionally, just the once, but obviously this is going to happen again. You should tell her that because I know you call in on each other in the way you Cornish people do. You should go around to her place and you could hand her this page of script and she'd be very impressed.
Okay. Well, I haven't got the page of script. I've got it on my computer. You're the only one who prints these things out.
Well, you should print it. It's like a Christmas card.
But do you have a printer in your house?
I do have a printer in my house, but the script for the take is so many pages and takes so much ink that I get it done elsewhere. Or in this case, it was sent round from our good production team.
When you say you get it done elsewhere, do you mean you go to Greatest Hits Radio and steal their their stuff? Is that what you do?
They do it, yes.
They print it up at Bauer?
Yep, they do. It's part of the deal.
I love the fact that you go into a place of work to steal their ink.
I don't steal their ink. They're very supportive of what we do.
Simon Mayo, ink thief.
No, I don't. I think The Ink Thief was actually a very successful book. Anyway, Dear Barton Fink and Annie Hall. Who's this? Hang on a second. There's a long email from someone. Marcus.
Yeah.
In Sully, South Wales.
Okay.
Whilst not particularly a hill I'd wish to die upon, I've recently found myself thinking about Simon's dislike for films named after their titular fictional character.
Yeah, this is a big deal for you.
Witness in take one, my confusion for...
We started talking about Ella McKay and you thought I was talking about J. Kelly.
Fictional characters, interchangeable. We've never heard of them.
Dolores Claiborne, where'd you stand on that?
No, bad. Definitely bad. Anyway, whilst I don't disagree, that's the important bit, says Marcus.
Okay.
I wondered if this dislike extended to other areas of the arts. And whether he'd prefer that the following works had different names: Emma, Jane Eyre, Robinson Crusoe, Nicholas Nickleby, David Copperfield, Oliver Twist, Harry Potter, Anna Karenina, Dracula, Columbo, House, Kojak, Frasier, Ally McBeal, T.J. Hooker, Ironside, Inspector Morse, Jack Reacher, Hamlet, Othello, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Bridget Jones' Diary. Even the great Stephen King is guilty of this offence with Carrie, Cujo, and Christine, just some of the books named after fictional characters. Some of the above works have also been made into films. In those cases, would Simon prefer that their film names were changed? Yes. Then there's the many successful, critically acclaimed films named after their fictional lead, alongside Annie Hall. Who could think of a better name for their respective films than John Wick, Jackie Brown, or Forrest Gump? Perhaps it comes down to the name itself. J. Kelly doesn't seem a particularly remarkable or memorable or interesting name,
I think,
as I write it. Apologies to any J. Kellys listening to this. Or perhaps it's all hindsight, and if the work of art is good, the name stands up as an acceptable title. Anyway, none of this is important, given that the world is going to hell in a handcart, but this is a particular deck chair I've decided to rearrange as we sink into the welcoming sea. Oh, and isn't there an excellent children's book named after Itchingham Loft? tinkety-tonk, marketing.
Yeah, Simon Mayo.
As everyone knows, this is a film thing. It's not a TV thing. It's not a book thing.
Oh, I see. So hang on. So the Stephen King novel, Dolores Claiborne, is fine.
Yes.
But the film, Dolores Claiborne, is not fine.
I would maintain that The Shining or The Stand, for example, Shawshank Redemption, are better titles than
Jack Torrance.
Than Dolores Claiborne. It's not good. Stephen, come on. Anyway, but obviously, you know, House and Hamlet and Othello, they've been quite good, you know.
One of the things that I'm really jealous of is that Edgar Wright has developed a text relationship with Stephen King, that they just text each other a lot. And I'm just like, you know, all the accolades and the success and all the rest of it, but he's texting Stephen King.
I know. That is pretty good. But you text Kate Winslet. So, you know, that's
out there. Yeah. And Johnny Greenwood.
Thanks for
how did the Famalam enjoy the concert?
Apparently Copenhagen was a great concert.
It was wonderful, wonderful Copenhagen.
It was. Though apparently Danes are notoriously quiet in concerts, but not with Radiohead because they love Radiohead.
Okay. There was a little bit of vid that Child One sent back. It was Child One, wasn't it?
It was Child One, yes.
And they were playing one of their hits. And Johnny Greenwood, who really, really needs to win the Oscar for his score for the Wombat Laughter film. Text him every now and then. I go, can you do this? And he goes, I can't. I'm touring with my Popular Beat combo.
Yeah, which is not a bad reply, really. If you've got an excuse, then you might as well use it.
I just love the fact that he refers to Radiohead as his Popular Beat combo.
Correspondence at kermanandmayo.com. Tell us about this David Bowie film then.
Yes. Yeah, so it's Bowie, the final act. It's in cinemas from December the 26th. It is apparently from the award-winning team behind Freddie Mercury, the final act, of which I was not aware. It's a documentary by Jonathan Stasny about David Bowie. The promotional line says, 10 years after David Bowie's passing, his final chapter comes to light. Discover how the legendary artist transformed life, death, and creativity into his haunting masterpiece, Black Star. So the film includes interviews with key musical collaborators from Rick Wakeman to Earl Slick, Tony Visconti, Mike Garson. Here is a little bit of Tony Visconti recalling Bowie telling him how ill he was.
I cried my eyes out. He's my lifetime friend, since the 60s. I started mumbling things like, don't worry, we'll get through this. We'll get the best doctors in the world. You're strong. You're going to get over this. I just started blabbering like that. And he comes on my side of the table and he starts hugging me. Given what he knew about his own health and all that, I think he wanted to make the best album of his life.
So it's funny. It's one of those things, isn't it? I still can't quite believe we live in a world that doesn't have Bowie in it anymore, and yet it so much does because of, I think, going to be huge Bowie fans. Anyway, so the film moves back and forth between Bowie's later life reinventions, and there's the whole thing about after Let's Dance, it's his work with Tin Machine, which was kind of, you know, critically panned, and then the lead up to the later albums, you know, which suddenly he appears out of nowhere, and then we get, you know, Where Are We Now, and then Black Star, and it contrasts that with his earliest work, you know, the DRAM stuff and Space Oddity, inventing and then killing off Ziggy Stardust, reinventing himself on Young Americans. And the suggestion is that all the way through his career, it has been a succession of deaths and rebirths, that reinvention is kind of central to it. So it maps this out partly by the kind of those two poles of the Glastonbury's, because he's at Glastonbury, is it the second Glastonbury, is it 1971, when he plays at the plays on the stage at 5 p.m. in the morning. And anyone who was there remembers this as being, the, you know, people were waking up.
Do you mean 5 a.m. in the morning?
5 a.m. in the morning, sorry, I beg your pardon. 5 a.m. in the morning. Okay, this is like, you and I recorded a show in which I wanted to say this show hasn't gone out yet, but I kept wanting to say, I kept saying Neil Young when I meant Neil Diamond. So it's 5 a.m. in the morning. And then, of course, the turn of the century return to Glastonbury, which is the thing which then kind of begins the reinvented career in the 21st century, in that phase of his thing, what the documentary is sort of calling the final act. So you've got archive interviews with Bowie, including that brilliant interview with Jeremy Paxman, in which David Bowie basically predicts just how much the internet is going to change everything. And Paxman is doing that very Paxo thing of going, is it? Is it though? Is it? And Bowie's going, yeah, believe me, no one has got any grasp of how much this is going to change everything. And it is both exhilarating and terrifying. And you think, wow, you really did genuinely foresee the future. You've got that. You've got live footage. You've got, you know, videos, but all of this stuff I could watch forever. I mean, I just love watching Bowie. There's also interviews with people like Gary Kemp, with Goldie, with Hanif Qureshi, who of course worked with him on Buddha of Suburbia. And look, it's very difficult in the wake of Moon Age Daydream to make a doc about Bowie that's not going, that's not revisiting familiar ground. And also because Moon Age Daydream was such a sort of an amazing visual theatrical experience. I mean, you know, it played in IMAX and people just were completely spaced out by how wild it was to see all that stuff. That said, Moon Age Daydream did lean much more heavily into what we think of as the classic 20th century Bowie period. And this is much more interested in the later stuff. For me, the most interesting stuff was hearing Tin Machine collaborators talking about what the Tin Machine project was and how hard it was when some of the reviews of the Tin Machine were as bad as they were. And it's interesting because I've got the Tin Machine records and I can't say that I go back to them very much. I think I've listened to them a few times, but it's not something that works for me. And yet I do find the Tin Machine period interesting because there is something about, I'm just going to completely reinvent myself this time by actually trying to reinvent myself as a member of a band. Now, Mark Radcliffe always used to say this thing about Tin Machine, you know, David Bowie of the David Bowie band, because no matter what you do, David Bowie is David Bowie. But there was something really interesting about that. And listening to the, you know, listening to a Tin Machine member explaining what the Tin Machine project was trying to do and how much resistance there was to it is really fascinating. And also then just all the stuff about the fun. I was involved in a thing when the Bowie thing happened at the V&A, right? There was a roundtable discussion with a bunch of people that was then transcribed and went into the V&A catalog for the Bowie exhibition. And at that point, Bowie hadn't released anything for a while. And they were asking everybody, you know, what would you ask Bowie? And I said, and this is just completely coincidental, I said, I just ask him, what's next? What are you doing next? Because I don't believe that he's stopped. I'd say, what next? And then, of course, you then get those final records, which I think stand alongside all of his best work. And I think the most incredible thing about Bowie is it is arguable that one of the greatest albums he made was the last thing he ever did. And so you can literally go from, you know, Man of Words, Man of Music, Space Oddity, all the way through to Black Star and go, there were ups and downs. There were periods when the record companies weren't interested. There's one thing which is fascinating is people talking about how there was a period when he'd become unfashionable, when he had sort of become, you know, a bit like, okay, fine, is he doing anything that's relevant anymore? But the constant reinvention. But the thing is, I love Bowie and I would watch anything about Bowie that has interviews with people that work with Bowie. Hearing from Earl Slick was really interesting.
So is this for Bowie fans, or is this going to be a, you know, just go and see it?
I suspect it's for Bowie fans. It's not the cinematic experience that you know, that Moon Age Daydream was, because that really was a cinema experiential thing.
Yeah.
But it's a documentary about Bowie for Bowie fans that's particularly interesting if you're interested in the later period. And like as I said, for me, because I don't think I ever even read an interview with Tin Machine. So that was really interesting.
Email here from Aroha Nui, which starts, "Hi, Carol," which is, of course, a Pluribus reference.
Very good. Very good. And then they should go on to say, "We're not here at the moment." No, what is it? This is a recorded message.
Yeah, it goes on.
Yeah.
"With reference to the question Schmestian the other week, which asked, what's the best one line you've overheard in real life with zero context that you could build an entire film around? About 20 years ago, I was making my way through airport security en route to catch a flight to go skiing. My carry-on bag had gone through the scanner, but had been selected for inspection, so I was waiting in line to be questioned. In front of me was a man, also waiting, who was dressed for warmer climes than where we were going. The security officer dealing with him said," and here's the line.
Okay.
"I just need to wipe my nose, excuse me."
Can I just say, I'm very impressed by the fact that you are soldiering on despite being as sick as a dog.
Yes. Well, you know, Dr. Footlights has been attending to my every need, but Dr. Footlights is on the wane as we speak. Anyway, so here's the line, right, from the security officer. "No, sir, you cannot go because you need to explain to the police why you hid this knife," holds up a large butcher's knife, "inside this loaf of bread," holds up half a loaf of bread. "I was agog, but I know nothing else, for I was moved along. The mind boggles, but thank goodness for airport security
staff." That's genius. That is absolute genius.
I mean, there isn't an innocent excuse, is there?
No.
If you've got a butcher's knife hidden in a loaf of bread and you're taking it through. And anyway, what made you think that they wouldn't pick up on that?
Yeah. Also, it that shows a basic misunderstanding of how X-ray works.
Yeah. Anyway, Aroha, thank you, because that's fantastic.
Wow.
One frame back this week is because of Amadeus. We've been asking you about Paul Bettany's best performance.
Rock me, Amadeus. Yes.
Nick M. "My favorite is definitely his role as Chaucer in A Knight's Tale, but I think it's Maturin in Master and Commander. He's fantastic as well. I think it's Maturin. Great. Dylan says, "I know Mark's going to say Gangster number one, but I'm going with Margin Call." Mark Hoogland says, "Master and Commander, amazing dynamic with Russell Crowe." Jennifer says, "I loved him as the unconventional titular literature professor in Uncle Frank." And Emma says, "Great as Charles Herman in A Beautiful Mind." So if you're going to say Gangster number one, you have to give us one other thing as well.
Margin Call.
Okay, that's that done.
Because he's great in that. I mean, I honestly think Paul Bettany is great in pretty much everything, even Wimbledon, which I think he's not overly fond of.
Yes, I think that's fair.
And Dogville, which he had a really tough time on, after which he actually decided that he wasn't going to act anymore. Remember that?
I was annoyed. Usually after every interview, yeah, I'm annoyed that I either didn't have time for a question,
yeah,
or forgot to ask a question, or for some reason didn't include a question.
Yeah.
And I did want to talk to him about Margin Call, because I know I've mentioned it a couple of times recently, but it's such a fantastic film.
Brilliant.
And I think my guess is it's not on because it's got Kevin Spacey in it, but when you watch it, I mean, it's worth hunting out, because all of the performances are great. Paul Bettany is great. Kevin Spacey is great. Stanley Tucci is amazing. I just think it's...
Jason Isaacs is amazing.
But apart from the fact that the technology, you know, it's a clunky computers and clunky mobile phones, what they're talking about... Oh, and Jeremy Irons being the most Jeremy Irons.
Yeah, that was why I said Jason Isaacs. That was the joke.
Okay. I'm ill. Don't mock me.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Jeremy
Explain
Irons,
it to me as you yes. would to a small child or a Labrador puppy.
That's right. This is the man who's just landed in his helicopter on the roof of the building. Really, really, really great. Okay, now that's very good. Margin Call, Dylan, you're right. Mark, you're right. Very good. Double bill with Gangster number one. John from Tenby, dear Push and Pineapple, long-term listener, I couldn't tell you how long, but I have a distinct memory of laughing at Mark ranting about the first Pirates film when driving through Bath sometime around 2004.
Okay,
first time emergency mailer. I enjoyed Mark reciting the lyrics to Agadoo last week, right up to the point when he got it wrong.
Did I?
Mark said, Agadoo, push pineapple, shake the tree.
Agadoo, push pineapple, black coffee.
No.
No?
Agadoo, push pineapple, shake the tree. Agadoo, push pineapple, grind coffee.
Oh, grind coffee. Oh, yeah,
I only mentioned
it's an action.
Because for quite some time, I thought that Noel Gallagher was going to start a revolution from Minehead, which I could only conclude was because he'd experienced a bad weekend at Butlin's. I wouldn't want Mark to go through life always wondering about the black coffee lyric. It was grind coffee, and everyone did a little mime of grinding coffee shaking the tree.
Right.
Anyway, love the show, Stephen. Down with all the usual. John from Tenby. Right. Thank you very much indeed. Now, there's a seasonal film that is out.
Yes. This is in the chart. So I promised in take one that I would review Silent Night, Deadly Night in take two, because obviously I saw it week of release, but then our week of release show was the Christmas special. So Silent Night, Deadly Night, 18 for strong bloody violence and gore. This is the second remake of the festive slasher, which I'd forgotten this, right? When Silent Night, Deadly Night came out originally back in the 80s, the poster for it said, you made it through Halloween, now try and survive Christmas, right? And there was a stink about it. So the plot followed a young man who, as a kid, he sees his parents are killed by a man dressed as Santa Claus, and then he grows up to be a similarly attired killer, you know, so it's driven by trauma. And there were these ads featuring Santa with an axe and a knife. And the outrage in Murica, which has got the weirdest, you know, oh, give like a baddie Christmas. They've got such a weird relationship with their traditions that there was a group set up called Citizens Against Movie Madness, who picketed theatres where Silent Night, Deadly Night was being shown because they thought it was horrific that somebody had done this with Father Christmas. And the people who made the film went, he's not a religious figure. You know that, don't you? It's not blasphemy. Father Christmas isn't in the Bible.
Yeah, and it's never existed. Ever.
No, it's right. It's not true. It's like that thing about when the lunatic fundamentalist got cross with Darren Aronofsky for reinventing the story of a 400-year-old man who builds a flying zoo, floating yes. zoo. Anyway, flying zoo would have been
flying
fun.
Zoo. Flying that zoo would have been particularly.
So anyway, so there was all this fuss and it was all this kind of picketing and bloody, bloody, blah. I mean, honestly, what is that country about? Just, I think, yeah. Anyway, yeah, so
moving on.
But so the film, the original film was fine. I mean, it wasn't a patch on. I just did an introduction to Black Christmas, which is great. The original Black Christmas, which is a really kind of dark feminist slasher movie. But anyway, that's a better film. But this did all right, partly, I suspect, because there was pickets and because there was all this fuss about it and people saying it's disgusting, it's disgraceful. And so it did okay. And it spawned a bunch of sequels, I think like four sequels. And then there was a sort of remake with Malcolm McDowell. Weirdly enough, Malcolm McDowell, he of Paul Bettany, that we were just having the conversation about, in 2010, 2012, something like that, something around that. Anyway, so now, second remake from writer-director Mike P. Nelson, okay? BBFC advice warns of use of weapons such as axes, bottles, and bows and arrows. People are stabbed, slashed, impaled, strangled, decapitated, have limbs severed, resulting in blood spurts and gore, and in one scene, a woman bites off a man's nose. Here's a clip.
Okay, that's good.
At Christmas time, I can see evil. I slipped from Billy into something else.
So you're crazy. I'm gonna figure out what's going on in there.
Yeah, no idea.
What?
Naughty.
Silent night.
Santa is always watching. Naughty boy. always get punished.
All is calm.
Lie.
All is bright.
He found the body. The person who did this. He was dressed like Santa.
Bad people need to be punished.
So that's generally the sound of it. So Rowan Campbell is Billy, who's the man who's with the Santa suited lust to kill, which he's inherited the mantle of the original killer, who now in this version sort of lives inside him as a, you remember that John Wyndham thing, Chocky, as a kind of Chocky style voice or ram in his head called Charlie. And the voice basically tells him that there are people who deserve to die. There are people on the naughty list. And he has to kill them. But if he doesn't keep up with killing them, if he doesn't, because he's got like an advent calendar of murders that he has to do one a day, and then he has to fill in the advent calendar by putting his bloody thumbprint on the calendar, which is quite a nice touch. If he doesn't do it, somebody else innocent will get killed. So he has to do the killings, and that's the thing. So he arrives at this town of, is it called Hackett, and he befriends Pam. Pam, who's played by Ruby Modine, daughter of Matthew Modine, and singer of a brilliantly haunting version of This Land Is Our Land on the most recent incarnation of the Wrong Turn movie, which was also directed by Mike Nelson. She apparently, Ruby Modine, is the lead singer of Ruby Modine and the Disease, and she's in the Happy Death Day movies. And she's also on the soundtrack of this, doing a similarly haunting version of an old classic, and she's got an amazing voice. Anyway, as with Wrong Turn, this breathes some new life into what could well be a tired old formula. The central characters are good. They're very good kind of odd couple. We get the antlers stuff again. The central conceit of Billy being a sort of kindly avenging angel, in as much as he has to do what he does, because if he doesn't do it, then innocent people are going to die. It has to be bad people are going to die. And in one standout scene, he turns up at a white power gathering, and then the instruction comes up on the screen in a very Gaspar Noé style, which is kill Nazis. And then there is a scene in which he kills Nazis. And as we've established many times before, there's a whole bunch of movies in which the thing is you go, you're allowed to kill Nazis. That's absolutely fine because they're Nazis.
What was the antler scene that you referred to?
If you're a, because I don't want to spoil anything, but if you're a fan of this particular franchise, yes. Death by Antlers.
Okay.
You know.
Oh, okay. That's not a very good way to go.
No, it's not. But you know, the ending sets this up for a sequel. And honestly, I'm kind of, you know, I'm not sure we need it, but I'd have no objection to it because I thought this was kind of, you know, it did what it did and it was kind of fun. And certainly in terms of the slew of these movies, this is up at the better end of them.
Rightio. Now, before I fall over and lie on the carpet, it's time for our questions and the schmestions with this piece of music.
Smestions.
Dear George and Mildred, says Paul McElroy, curmudgeon and listener since the before times, with reference to last week's question addressing what you would find most difficult if you went back to the year of your birth.
Yes.
But as an adult. If it's any time before the mid-1980s, I think the thing you might have missed is the boredom of Sunday afternoon.
Sing something simple.
I don't think it's possible to fully express to anyone born after this era the interminable length of time between 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. with nothing on the telly, no shops or pubs open, and parks and playgrounds that would be padlocked shut until Monday morning.
Yep.
The Douglas Adams phrase, long dark tea time of the soul, comes close, but even that doesn't convey the full horror. Tinkety-tonk, down the Nazis. Congratulations to your team, whose peerless professionalism is matched only by their dress sense, sharp haircuts, elevated cheekbones, and buckets of riz.
Well,
but whatever.
Riz. Do you remember Sing Something Simple?
Yeah, it came on after the top 40.
Yeah, that was the only thing that was on.
And then it's a bit like when the Archers music comes on, it's a race to get to the volume control before it starts so you can just switch it off. But there's a great... I only found this out in retrospect because I don't remember Tony Hancock, but there is a very famous Tony Hancock episode which starts with him saying, oh, I hate Sundays, and going through all the reasons why Sundays are the most boring. And it definitely was.
Yeah.
Utter, utter tedium.
The worst thing about Sunday was, and probably still is, Saturday is great because you've got Sunday tomorrow. But Sunday is rubbish because you've got Monday tomorrow.
Yeah, and Morrissey did do Every Day's Like Sunday, which I know he, you know, you can't quote him anymore, but that was back in the day when you could, you knew exactly what he meant. Well, people of that age.
Yeah, back exactly in the day before he became a full 100% of the time arse.
Yes, yes, precisely. Gemma says, I recently learned that you could fit 1.3 million Earths inside the sun. But
really?
But 10 billions of our sun can fit suns can fit inside Stevenson 218, the largest star yet discovered. And don't get me started on TON618. My brain hurts already. My question is, what fact do you know that is almost impossible to comprehend?
Donald Trump is the president of America.
Classic. I mean, how did I possibly guess that that's what you're going to say? I will join in the spirit of Gemma's question. Octopuses have three hearts.
No.
Sharks were around before trees.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I know one. I know one.
Go on.
Crocodiles and alligators are not descendant from the same thing.
What are they descended from then?
Different things. They are genetically separate. They are not two versions of the same thing. Crocodiles and alligators happened, you know, separately without connection.
If you took your DNA and unraveled it, you could get to Pluto and back.
Okay, wow.
Okay, I mean, these are all kind of... Is this the kind of stuff you wanted, Gemma? I suspect it probably is. Ryan in Cape Town. Good day, Beavis and Butthead. The last time I asked a question, I was taken down a rabbit hole by Mark and Sanjeev on cover versions that may have led me to William Shatner performing Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which I will never be able to unsense.
No.
On the 31st of December, MTV here in South Africa, and I believe also on your side of the world, will be shutting down. This is true.
Oh, is MTV stopping?
Yeah. From the first music video on MTV, The Buggles, Video Killed the Radio Star. In 81, to whatever will close it in a few weeks' time, which music video is your personal favourite and which video do you believe will still be impactful in 50 years' time? May you both have a blessed Christmas with those who bring you the most out of life.
Well.
Thank you.
Well.
Well, I'll go first then.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the ones... I guess I haven't sort of made a point of watching videos for a long time, but let's start at the very beginning, a very good place to start. Bohemian Rhapsody is 50 years old. And when we first saw that on Top of the Pops, we went to school and we talked
about
it.
Our minds were blown.
No one had done anything like that. So I would say that, Thriller, Sledgehammer, Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, that's great.
Take On Me by A-ha.
That's the animated one, yep.
Yes, it is. But this extra bit, which video do you believe will still be impactful in 50 years' time?
Well, can I throw one in?
Yeah, go on.
I think Sinead O'Connor's video for Nothing Compares to You, I think has aged better than almost any video ever because it's just that shot. You know, I know there's the bit in the, you know, the cutaway during the instrumental bit. I love the Bowie video for Ashes to Ashes because, again, I remember us all talking about it.
Yes.
I remember the Ultravox video to Vienna and just thinking, what is this preposterous nonsense?
Yeah, love the track, but the video is not it's not as good as it should be.
And then there was, you know, all the Duran Duran videos. Was it Russell Mackay did a lot of those? And they were all sort of, you know, like huge, big production numbers and utterly preposterous. There was the video that went with Jazz In For Blue Jean, the Bowie thing. And then there was that Man Trap thing that came out with ABC's Lexicon of Love.
Yeah.
That was kind of interesting.
I would, in a terrifyingly almost up-to-date reference.
Right.
To answer Ryan's question about impactful in 50 years' time, I haven't seen this for a while, but Childish Gambino's This Is America is a fairly astonishing video.
Okay.
Which I suspect in 50 years' time will still be impactful. But
okay. But I do think that Nothing Compares to You video will be impactful because it's just her face. And I mean, it's an amazing rendition of that song. I think that version is brilliant, and I think it is the definitive version, which sadly they weren't allowed to use in that documentary about Sinead O'Connor, which was terrible because the estate wouldn't let her use it. Prince's estate wouldn't let them use it. But I think that video will remain impactful, which is a word I don't like, because it is just her face, and it's a masterclass of performance.
Yes, it is. Neil Aldridge in San Diego. When I saw Tenet back in 2020, I enjoyed it and understood it. I've just watched it again and barely understood a bit of it, which seems perfectly in keeping with the theme. Should I watch it backwards now? Yeah.
That'll work.
It's not much of a question, really, but it's worth... I haven't watched it since it came out.
No, me neither.
Now that my head's a bit befuddled, I might watch it and see if I get a better insight to it. Maybe I'll do that this afternoon.
One of the theories in Room 237, the documentary about The Shining, is that if you play The Shining forwards and backwards at the same time, the backwards version of it creates a visual conversation with the forwards version of it.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, if I've got spare time this afternoon after I've done Tenet, forwards and backwards, I'll give it a go. Dear Buddy Boy and Fran, says Amanda, this is our last question.
Okay.
It has become a frequent habit in our household to run mini film festivals throughout the year.
Right.
It started with a horrorthon, my genre of choice, each Halloween, and expanded to 3 or 4 festivals a year, spanning 3 days and 9 films per event.
Wow.
This Christmas, we decided to abandon our traditional Christmas film festival and replace it with a New Year's event. But what should we include? After much head-scratching, we chose The Apartment, The Poseidon Adventure, and then, well, to be honest, that's as far as we got. Strange Days was scratched from the list because we watched it recently. Can you and the listeners help? What other films set at New Year should we add to our festival?
Well, there is that film called is it called New Year's Day or New Year's Eve?
Yeah. That, but it's terrible.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Yes. So the holdovers.
But that's Christmas.
But I think it goes into New Year.
Well, it goes into the beginning of the next term, doesn't it? Because there's the sacking.
Is it Happy New Year, Colin Burstead?
Yes.
Burstead?
That's right, Colin Burstead. That's right. The Ben Wheatley film. Yeah, that's
got to be included.
Yeah.
A brief bit of research this morning suggested that Assault on Precinct 13 is set at New Year, which, if that is true, wins. Trading Places is set at New Year.
Trading Places is, yeah.
Snowpiercer.
Yes, very good.
And the final card in my winning hand, When Harry Met Sally.
Well, it's not set. I mean,
It encompasses New Year.
Yeah. I mean, I would say there is a very good film by Reggie Yates from 2021 called Pirates, which is set, I mean, very much like Strange Days. It's the millennium. So it's New Year's Eve 1999 going into 2000.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a really lovely film. It's really, really well made. I honestly would recommend that. That is well worth doing. You're right about When Harry Met Sally, not least because the great Rob Reiner doing an amazing job of helming that film. And you're right. It absolutely does end with the New Year thing. Although there's the little thing at the end, isn't it? When they're doing the interview and there's stuff about on the side because you gotta like it because not everybody would like it on
does
the side.
Does the first Bridget Jones have a New Year party in it?
Might do.
Because there's the Christmas jumper, but I think there's a New Year thing in there.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, but I'm gonna fly. I mean, Strange Days is great, but it's amazing that you've seen it recently because it's really hard to get hold of. I did an interview with Rafe Fiennes about Strange Days. I think it was last year, and he said I haven't watched it since. Is it any good? I went, it's amazing. You really should go back and revisit it because it's an alarmingly prescient film. But Pirates is great.
If you were to add Assault on Precinct 13,
yeah.
When Harry Met Sally, that's...
That's a good... That's a pretty good lot, isn't it?
And Snowpiercer, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Snowpiercer is fine.
Okay, that's very good. So thank you very much, Lee, for all your questions. Please keep them coming into the new year, which is...
Well, soon. It's a way away. We're still this side of Christmas.
I know, but it's kind of soon. We've got to go through that interminable period between Christmas and New Year when no one knows what day it is, what time it is, who's supposed to be there. Do I eat this food? Can I still eat peanuts?
Didn't know what time it was. The lights were low. I leaned back on my radio. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll. Lot of soul, he said.
Yeah. That was a bit of a low key end to the show. But I'm now going to go and fall over and lie down and take some Lemsip. Thank you very much, Dean, for listening. Patreon is cool. Tell your friends. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you very soon.